You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of June 2017 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck on today's show.
Today, we have reached an agreement with the Conservative Party on support for government in Parliament.
It's not quite a coalition, but is going to require some getting along as the UK's wobbly Conservative government forms ties with Northern Ireland's DUP. We'll ask whether anyone thinks they can really go the distance. My guests, Robin Lustig and Marie Bion, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Donald Trump foregoes the White House's traditional Eid dinner. We'll find out why the US president isn't feeling so hungry.
Well, you're right about Islamophobia, and that's a shame. But whether we like it or not, and we can be very politically correct, but whether we like it or not, there is a problem.
And we'll look at the role of the media in highlighting the warning signs of London's Grenfell Tower tragedy. Could more have been done?
There are more than 100 people who died in this place.
Yeah, I understand that.
Not 10 or 15 people.
Why did they come here before? Why did they not come here before?
More than 100 persons.
That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robin Lustig, the journalist and broadcaster, and Marie Bion, UK correspondent for French media. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we're going to begin here in the UK, where the Conservative government has finally agreed an arrangement to have an even more conservative Northern Irish party, the DUP, propped up in a minority government. Coalition in the UK is a rare thing, and as such, Theresa May has had to bung the Northern Ireland region an extra £1 billion in funding to get the deal done. Robin, is this progressive politics?
No, it is the opposite. Neither of the two parties involved could be described, I don't think, as progressive. It's not exactly a match made in heaven either. This is a brutally cynical manoeuvre by a desperately weak government who have scurried around looking for the only party they could find who, to put it bluntly, could be bought off. As you say, £1 billion of extra money for Northern Ireland and the dropping of a few Conservative Party policies which wouldn't have been popular with the DUP's voters. Things like means testing benefits for older voters, removing the so-called triple lock on pensions, which would guarantee that pensions went up quicker than anybody else's income, that kind of thing. What I find so appallingly cynical about this is that it says to everybody else in British politics, Mrs. May can be bought. All you have to do is threaten to bring her down and she'll bung you some cash. Plainly, she's not going to do that for everybody, but that's what the path she has embarked on.
And Robin, just for our listeners who don't follow Northern Ireland politics, the DUP is a very conservative in its beliefs party. It, you know, for example, it's not very keen on gay rights. It's not very keen on women's rights in some senses as well.
The DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, was formed by one of the most controversial, in his time most bigoted, Protestant politicians in Northern Ireland, the Reverend Ian Paisley. He was a rabid anti-Catholic in his time, and the party was formed to support the interests of the Protestant Unionists, those in Northern Ireland who wanted the province to remain part of the United Kingdom, to resist any encroachment by the Catholics who wanted to be closer to or part of the Irish Republic. The DUP, it has to be said, over the last few years has lost some of that rabid bigotry, but that's the tradition from which it comes. It is, as you say, still very socially conservative. It still has a lot of support in Northern Ireland among the Protestants, and it has for many years now been cooperating, rather bizarrely, in government in Belfast with Sinn Féin, which is the political arm of what used to be the Irish Republican Army, the IRA.
Marie, when you look at the way that progressive politics unfolds on the continent, especially in France, a country that you cover a great deal, is this horse trading much more common in the French parliamentary system?
You mean trying to strike a deal to get to a coalition? Not exactly. No, coalition really don't exist in France. What you have is cohabitation. Is that if you don't have a majority, you can have a prime minister. The president chooses a prime minister that's not from his or her party. Well, it's always been his party because it's always been male presidents, and that's what happened. I mean, the same thing exactly happened a few years ago when Jacques Chirac was president. He thought, "I'm gonna dissolve the National Assembly because I'm sure I'm gonna win. I'm gonna have a better majority." And all's going to be plain sailing. Well, that's exactly what Theresa May did a few weeks ago, and she made a bad gamble, and Jacques Chirac made a bad gamble. He ended up with Lionel Jospin, the socialist, as prime minister, and for many years he hasn't been able to do anything because, of course, when you are from the right wing and you have a left-wing prime minister, it's not easy to do a lot of things. So that would be the equivalent in France, but that's quite different, of course, because there were socialist ministers as well in the government with the right-wing ministers. This time, Theresa May has been able not to have any DUP ministers in her government. And that was quite important because she wanted to govern on her own and to be seen still as the strong woman, not on the papers needing anyone on the day-to-day basis, which, of course, it doesn't. I mean, that might look like it, but I don't think anybody is dubbed.
The thing that has to be pointed out as well, Andy, is that even with this agreement, even with the DUP voting with her, she has a theoretical majority of precisely three. That means only two of her own MPs have to vote against her, and she's up the creek.
Now, Robin, there's also the strange thing that, you know, for many years under David Cameron, a politician and a prime minister that now many people feel didn't exactly play his hand very well. But the interesting thing was, whatever you thought about his policies on the economy, he was progressive on social questions. You know, he was the person who actually pushed through gay marriage here in the UK. And I think on issues of race and gender and sexuality, he was actually a proper liberal. He didn't care about what people's private lives was, and he genuinely wanted an equal society. Now, by embracing the DUP, in the long term, do you think Theresa May has, with all these partnerships, they often come with a bit of a sting at the end, and do you think that she will lose some people's support around her? Do you think, I just don't want to be, you know, pulling up over the bedsheets over me with the DUP underneath?
I doubt it, to be honest. First of all, there is no sign that she has conceded anything to the DUP on those kinds of issues. And her own instincts, I think, largely are pretty much similar to David Cameron's. Now, the DUP's views on those kinds of issues are very popular among its own electorate in Northern Ireland. It accepts, I think, that it is somewhat out of step with majority opinion in the rest of the United Kingdom. I would be surprised if that came up and bit Mrs. May in the backside. Much more likely are going to be economic issues and, of course, the shadow looming over everything, Brexit.
Marie, when you translate these kinds of stories for your audience back in France, the shift, the turning of tables in politics has been so rapid all over the world in recent weeks. But, you know, just a couple of months ago, we were looking at, you know, a potential disaster for France. You know, would we have a far right-wing government? You know, we now have the images of, you know, Macron on the weekend. You know, can he get any cooler? He was, like, playing wheelchair sports. He was kickboxing. He's like, poor old Pierre Trudeau, not Pierre Trudeau, poor old Mr. Trudeau seems to have lost all his credibility in
yeah.
You know, Justin's been completely kind of trumped by him. When you look at the Britain now, and you're telling the stories here from the UK back for France, what's your take on where we are at the moment?
Well,
I must say, you've got a look on your face that it says it's actually quite delicious telling these stories.
I mean, it's immensely interesting. And at last, I mean, I think I was banned to say Northern Ireland for the first four years I was here, because it doesn't mean anything to French people. Northern Ireland, Ireland, just don't talk about it. Talk about Great Britain, it's going to be easier. Now I can talk about Northern Ireland, so I'm quite happy about it. But I have to explain what Northern Ireland is and the difference between Ireland, because of course, I mean, it's quite complicated for French audience to understand the separation and the difference between Northern Ireland in terms of conservatism and this kind of thing, and the rest of Great Britain. I mean, the fact that abortion is not the same in Northern Ireland that it is in the rest of Great Britain, and gay marriage the same, is very complicated to make understand to French people, where the law is the same for everyone in France. Everybody's equal, whatever the region. And that's quite important, because of course Corsica would like to be more independent. There's a few regions that would like to be more independent, and it's so important for the French state to be completely harmonious. So it's quite interesting to talk about that. And I mean, it's quite nice to talk about Mr. Macron also in the UK. But what's happening now with Macron? I mean, we realize more and more that he's very skilled communicator, and he's been, as you say, he's been doing all those things over the weekend, and Canadians have been worried that Justin Trudeau is not that cool anymore. But and some say also that, I mean, there's a lot of communication sin that Trudeau did, and that people should stop falling for that. And I guess the French media are exactly in the same path. I mean, they realize that Emmanuel Macron is generally perhaps a nice guy, and he's a new man and this kind of thing, but he's doing a bit too much at the moment to try to appear cool, and it looks like he wants to appear cool to make us forget that he's tightening his grip on the power. He's a bit of a control freak. I mean, for example, he wanted to choose, namely, the journalist that would go on his plane on a visit. I can't remember if it was Mali or somewhere else. That's not something that you can do. And he wants to convene the two chambers of parliament in Versailles at the beginning of July, which is something that you don't do unless there's a big crisis in the country. And thanks to his election, there's no big crisis in the country at the moment. So that means that he's really tightening grip on the power in France. And so the cool guy appears to be a bit cold-headed, and it's more and more showy in France. And that's quite interesting as well. But it still looked like that, yes, France was the one who was completely lost a few months ago, and now the UK, its table has turned completely.
It's so funny, you know, how history repeats itself. When I look at people swooning over Emmanuel Macron, and I saw them swooning over Justin Trudeau, and I remember somebody, a British politician called Tony Blair, who was young and good-looking and hip and cool and wore blue jeans in Downing Street and played the guitar and did all those things. And yeah, what happened to him?
But it's interesting, because at the weekend, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour
Party.
Neither
young nor cool nor hip.
No, but... you know,
cool,
maybe you can be old and cool.
He appeared at Glastonbury, and the crowd loved him. And that sense of being able to play a big audience, we know that Theresa May is just terrible at it, and was, you know, secreted away and only allowed to meet, you know, half a dozen people at any campaign rally. And you can't imagine her in her wildest nightmares or dreams going up on the stage of Glastonbury to speak to the crowd and try and persuade them. Do you think it matters that
yeah,
ability
I do,
to
actually.
Connect?
Yes, I think, funnily enough, Corbyn at Glastonbury probably cut through in a way which virtually nothing else he has done did, since he failed to sing the national anthem shortly after he was elected leader of the Labour Party. Gestures do matter. Images matter hugely. Adoring crowds matter hugely. Ask Donald Trump how important rallies are, and that sense of... well, it's demagoguery, and it's odd to refer to Corbyn in the same breath as Trump, but different as their politics are, there are some similarities. It's weird.
Well, talking of Mr. Trump, this weekend just gone saw the beginning of Eid take place across the world. The event marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan for Muslims, and it sees the end of the month-long fast with festivities and some rather good food. But one place that won't be inviting guests is the White House. The Trump administration has opted not to host the annual White House Eid dinner. It's a tradition that's been held regularly since the Clinton era. Marie, what does this tell us about what's going on in the White House?
I guess it's not surprising. He's doing the mistake that a lot of people who don't really think a lot do, putting Muslims in the same basket, saying that there's a problem with Islam because of all the extremism and terrorism that's happening in the world. That's exactly the contrary that he should do. He should have more than any other year preside over this festivities to show these are the real Muslims and these are the ones that are completely welcome in the White House and in the US, and these are the ones that we need to promote against those very, very bad guys. And he failed to do that. He did what I think people who don't really think a lot do. They just put everyone in the same basket, and they don't. And he's supposed to be the leader of the country, and he's not leading them in the right direction. He's a demagogue, and he wants everybody to love him. And of course, those who love him are mainly, I guess, those who would be at least wary of Muslims. And the fact that he decided not to stage and host this dinner just makes those people think that they are right, and perhaps they should be even more wary to Muslim than they are today. So I think it's a very, very bad show to...
We must say he did put out a statement, which, yes, and so did Rex Tillerson. But they is the cancelling of the event, which is again, we talked about images, Robin. It's another clear statement from him that he doesn't want to carry all Americans with him on his journey.
I'll tell you what I think's going on. I think he got some very negative feedback from his base after he cuddled up to the Saudis, after he discovered his new best friends in Riyadh. And was photographed having a good time with the people who a lot of Trump supporters blame for 9/11, and not without some reason. He discovered that this hadn't gone down very well, and he took a decision, and probably in his own weird world, it was the right decision, that he had to go easy a little bit on cuddling up to any kind of Muslim leader or Muslim community. And as Marie says, there are plenty of people in America who voted for Donald Trump because of what he said about Islam, wrong as it was, what he said about Muslims, wrong as it was. And he just needs to shore up that base, because support for Trump is leeching away, and he can't afford to alienate the core.
Just before we move, I'm going to bring Marie back in, but you make a strong statement there that it's leeching away. Do you genuinely think that? Because, you know, we've just had a vote that saw, you know, him actually quite victorious on two of them. Well, first of all, he's just had today the Supreme Court hold up in part much of his so-called ban on Muslim travel. And, you know, he doesn't seem to have been defeated yet in any of these kind of local elections either.
No, but nor has he done any of the things that he promised he would do. He has not reformed Obamacare. He has not reformed the tax system. He has not built a wall along the border with Mexico. He is in deep trouble over the fraught issue of contacts between Russia and his campaign during the election. I know at the moment this is still something mainly of interest to the New York Times and the Washington Post, but it is having an effect, I think. He needs to watch his base. That's my belief.
Marie, I guess the other problem is that would anyone have turned up? For, on the other side, things are so fraught now that it would be difficult for many Muslim leaders to turn up to the White House and just pretend that nothing was going on. Do you think that there may also be, in a sense, that, you know, he could have been snubbed a little bit here?
I don't know the leaders, the Muslims in the US, so I wouldn't be able to say, to talk about that. But I do think that the philosophy would be to try and patch things up. That would be, as I understand it, that would be the philosophy of the Muslims, the religious leader of the Muslim community, trying to patch things up, trying to show and to showcase the Muslim community in the right light. And what better way than to do it exactly in front of the man who's leading the crowd to be wary of the Muslims? I mean, it was a great stage for the religious leaders to show who they were for real. Would it have worked? I'm not sure. With Trump, I'm not sure he would have been able to understand that or willing to understand that. It would not have been politically good for him to understand that. But it's true that maybe a few, some Muslims in the US would not have been happy with their leaders to cozy up with Trump. I mean, that would have been a bit controversial. But I still think that at the basis of everything, at the end of the day, the important is to try and patch things up and show the real Muslims. And that was a great opportunity to do it.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Marie Bion and Robin Lustig. Up next, we'll talk the Grenfell Tower tragedy, local press and the dangers of taking a good book on a flight. Find out more about that after this.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You're listening to Midori House, still with me are Robin Lustig and Marie Bion. Accountability for the tragedy of Grenfell Tower, the apartment block in West London that was consumed by fire a week and a half ago, killing at least 79 people, with many more presumed missing, has been sought everywhere from local government to the Prime Minister. But there's also anger at the media. As the timeline of the building comes under the spotlight, it's been revealed that the residents' numerous complaints about safety were underreported or not reported at all. Part of the blame has been placed on the collapse of local media in the internet age, with shrinking news teams seeking broader narratives and global clicks rather than the nitty-gritty of engaging with a community. Marie, now I know you went down this as the fire was happening, you were reporting it for radio. You've seen this event unfold. How concerned are you about this disappearance of this network of local reporting? And we have seen proper anger from some of the people who were there saying, look, you know, why are you turning up with your news trucks now? As a, not just because of the safety issues to do with the building, but a general feeling that they are a community that nobody takes any notice of.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the reason why we were all there and we were all packed around the security cordon, the only reason we were there was to try and talk to people who were traumatized or who would tell us, you know, the punch phrase that we could use in our newspapers or in our report in radio. We were not here or there for the good reasons somehow. It's just afterwards that we talked about the solidarity and this kind of thing. So we were here to collect the ashes, in a way, of this building. I don't know. I mean, I've worked for a local newspaper in France, in the northwest of France, at the start of my career. I thought it was, I dreamt of going to Paris and London, so I didn't appreciate it the way I should. But now I wish sometime, with all the news that's happening, I wish sometime I was back in my little town of Saint-Nazaire and covering local news. And because I understand now a bit more the aim of a local newspaper. Of course, you have to name all the kids going to a football match because you know you want their parents to buy the newspaper. But at the same time, you have a very real and tangible role to play in the community. If you do things right, you know, if someone is coming to tell you from a tower block they are worried about security issues, you are supposed to investigate. And now at the moment there's so little money in those newspapers. Would you have the time to detach a journalist to investigate on something like that? I'm not sure today, even if there were local press, that's something that would be done, although that would be the ultimate role of the new.
Robin, you've seen the world of media change and the world of news gathering change, but even 20 years ago, an organisation like the BBC or most newspapers, they would have a chain kind of going back to local newspapers that brought recruits up through the process, and there was a sense that, you know, even in the smallest local newspaper, there were people training who would end up being, you know, great journalists, and it was an important job to do.
That's absolutely true. However, I think one needs to be a little bit careful about getting too misty-eyed with nostalgia about the role of the local press. Most local newspapers were not good at reporting the events of the fears of people like those living in Grenfell Tower. They were largely representative of local business. They existed to advertise local businesses. They failed largely, and they did fail the local papers, because they didn't represent the communities among whom they were circulated. People didn't buy them, and they ceased to be viable business propositions. Of course, there should be vibrant local media. Whether it's print media, whether it's online media, is open to discussion. I don't think anybody really could argue that the awful events of Grenfell Tower wouldn't have happened had there been a more active local media. The faults are far more serious, actually, than a media fault. They're to do with regulation, they're to do with political responsibility, they're to do with conceivable corruption in terms of who was paying whom for what kinds of permits. We don't know. We will know eventually. There is going to be a full public inquiry, thank goodness. My suspicion is that some very ugly truths will emerge. Would they have emerged sooner if there had been a vibrant local press? I would love to think the answer to that was yes, but I'm not sure.
Well, we're going to end our show today by asking our guests, what are you reading? And would you be happy for airport security to have a nose in it too? Because in the US, newly trialled security measures from the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, mean that some travellers are having to unpack food, books and more before getting on a plane. And not everyone is happy about having officers leaf through their novel of choice. Okay, Marie Bjorn, what are you reading? And would you be happy for those officials to have a nose?
I wouldn't mind, but I guess it could be seen as a bit weird, because the book I'm reading is 1666, Plague, War and Hellfire. So it doesn't look very good. It's about, of course, the year 1666, but there's the number of the beast in it, and talking about hellfire and this kind of thing. At the moment, that's not me. That would not be exactly the most peaceful read to have on the plane, I guess.
What are you reading, Robin?
Well, I'm just back from the United States, and so I know what was in my luggage. I was carrying two books. One was called All Out War by Tim Shipman, which was the history of the Brexit campaign here in the UK. The other was called Dark Territory by an American security analyst and indeed friend of mine called Fred Kaplan, which is the history of cybersecurity and cyber warfare in the United States. If any security official had dug those two books out of my case, they would have taken one look and thought, we have a real weirdo here. Let's get him out.
But it is quite hard to judge passengers by what they're reading, because if someone's reading a book about terror, does it mean they support terror, or they're actually petrified of it and they're trying to understand it? So it's quite hard to know, apart from if it's a bomb-making manual, yes, what is exactly going to be the wrong book to have on you, isn't it, Marie?
Well, I guess the wrong book to have on you would be to have a Quran.
Really. Yes, I guess that they would be a little bit suspicious.
Sadly. Yeah, sadly, I think that would be the book that you would not want to have on yourself. And many Muslims have a Quran with them all the time, so that could be a bit of a problem for them, because sadly, perhaps people would not like to see a Quran in a plane. A Bible might be more welcome in the US. I mean, having a Bible on you, I mean, yes, of course, we don't need to look the other books that you have in your luggage. Please go into the plane, I think they would say. So I think that would be the most contentious read.
I think that's exactly what people are going to do. They're going to start choosing books which will impress the security guys at the airport. And the Bible, obviously, is the first one. The US Constitution would be another good one, I suspect, to have. And there are lots of those.
I think there's a few books by Mr. Trump that you would probably kind of get a few gold stars
for.
The Completed Works.
The Wit and Wisdom of Donald J. Trump. Yeah,
the Wit and Wisdom one is maybe a little bit shorter, but there's certainly quite a few books about his business views or acumen or not. But it is a kind of nerve-wracking thing, I always think, when you go up to the there's something about the whole process of going through that makes you feel that you're smuggling something, even when you've got...
Oh, yeah, you feel guilty even when you're not. You know, what are they looking for? What are they going to find? What have I forgotten to take out of my bag. It's difficult business.
Well, we're not going to frisk our guests before they leave. And I'd just like to thank Marie Bion and Robin Lusted for joining me today on Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Hans Adey Ashikalin. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next. And at 1900 hours, it's Culture with Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours. As London time, I'm Andrew Tuck, and goodbye.